We interrupt this program to bring you a special report.
Welcome to The Other Side of Midnight, hosted by Richard C. Hoagland. Tonight's special report, Pluto, The Last Encounter. And now, here's Richard.
Well, we have a most interesting program for you this morning. This is going to be one for the history books. About 50 years ago, in fact, 50 years ago exactly this morning, a little spacecraft sent by NASA into the dark called Mariner 4 was about to fly by the planet Mars for the first time in human history and take 22 pictures and send them very, very slowly back to Earth. Well, we now flash forward the film 50 years, half a century. Every time I say that, I can't believe that's really what's going on. And 50 years later, I find myself with my same co-host, Dick Pertell. Say hello, Dick.
Hello, Richard. How are you?
And we are going to do it all again, except this time we've kind of moved the planet. It's not Mars this time, Dick. It's Pluto, 3 billion miles away. How does it feel?
Well, it really blows my mind. It does.
It has been an extraordinary 50 years. I never imagined when we were sitting there in that auditorium, you know, all those decades ago doing the live show, that you and I would wind up on the radio again for another NASA encounter.
Well, you know, I've been thinking about this, Dick, and we really should do more shows, because this idea of getting together once every 50 years is a stretch of the imagination, I think.
What I want to do tonight, and what we're going to do for the audience, is to give them a perspective on history through the lens of NASA developments. When we did that show all those decades ago, and a little later in the program, we're going to actually play some excerpts, we made some predictions, both social predictions and technical predictions.
Yes, we did.
And what we're going to do is we're going to kind of go back and visit those and look at what's happened in the ensuing 50 years that matches, or in this case, sometimes doesn't match with those predictions. Now, We've got a correspondent live at the Mission Control Center for this extraordinary Pluto mission. His name is Keith Morgan. He has been with Ted Koppel for decade after decade, and I met him many years ago. We became good friends, and we've done several interesting projects together, including the inception of the original Enterprise Mission school project at Dunbar Senior High there on Capitol Hill. Well, tonight, Keith and Will Allen, his trusty assistant, have gathered our equipment and are at the Applied Physics Laboratory of Johns Hopkins out in Laurel, Maryland, which is the control center for the New Horizons mission, and it's also where all the press are gathering from all the networks and the wire services and the major papers and all the blogs and all the specialty online, you know, activities that go on around things like this. They're all gathered in what is kind of euphemistically called an interplanetary party there at the control center in Maryland. And so if we can see if our friend Keith Morgan is available. Are you there, Keith?
Yes, I'm here, Dick.
Why don't you give us a kind of an overview of a radio picture, as it were, of what's going on there and what we can expect during the rest of the morning?
Well, right now all the press is gathering and everybody's standing in the lobby waiting for people to get access to the auditorium and the other events.
You mean it's one of those hurry up and wait things?
Yeah, it's one of those. But so far, everything is looking very good, even though we know that the real event's going to take place probably at 9 o'clock tonight when the ET phones home. So
yeah, that's one of the weirdest parts of this mission, Dick. When you and I did the Mariner show 50 years ago, and I'm going to drop saying the 50 years ago because it's beginning to get on my nerves. Mm-hmm. When we did the Mariner 4 show, it was very primitive technology compared to what we're using, you know, this morning.
Oh, certainly it was, yeah.
And yet we had a live signal from that little spacecraft as it flew by Mars at 8 1/3 bits per second on the radio link. You had engineering data that would tell the ground and tell JPL and tell NASA what activities were taking place on the spacecraft. That's not at all what's going on this morning, is it?
Certainly, I don't know, Richard. that's beyond my capabilities.
See, that's the perfect co-host foil. When in doubt, throw it back to the first guy. Well, as someone who has lived through these missions over these decades, I can tell you categorically that I have never encountered a mission where you did not have what's called omni-radio beacons, that no matter what the attitude of the spacecraft, the little guy would stay in touch with Earth because the antenna pattern would still wash over the Earth and you would get some data at some very, very, very slow bit rate, even if it was only a trickle. With this mission, since last night at about 9 o'clock, I guess, Eastern time, the spacecraft has been silent because even though it's very sophisticated and about the size of a grand piano, and has this huge antenna several meters wide on one side of it, which it uses to send the data home, the instruments poke out of the grand piano at other angles. And because it doesn't have a scan platform, meaning a motorized device that would allow you to point the instruments independently of the spacecraft, when they are taking data, they can't send information home. And when they're sending information home, they can't take data. So for the next 24 hours or so, actually now it's a little under 18, I guess, we're going to be silent from Pluto, and everything will be done according to a computerized clock. The spacecraft should be doing this at this time. The spacecraft is being commanded to do this at that time. And we won't know anything about what actually is happening at Pluto until Eastern time, 9 o'clock tonight. That's amazing.
It is amazing, and I'm wondering if something were to go wrong with the spacecraft, would we know it?
No. Being out of touch, you would not only not know it, but also, and I think this is probably why the mission people made this decision when they were designing the spacecraft, because it takes so much power to punch a signal across space from 3 billion miles away, and it's a 4.5-hour trip for the radio waves at the speed of light. The engineers probably figure that, well, by the time we find out that something isn't working, there's nothing we can do about it anyway, so we might as well devote the time to taking data and then just turn around and, you know, phone home after everything is done, which is exactly how this mission is structured. We're not going to know that any of the activities we're talking about this morning have actually taken place until 9:02 this evening, Eastern time, when that little phone home signal is supposed to be coming back along with a few priceless images and some other data before the spacecraft goes back to taking more data as it continues to recede from the Pluto system.
Well, I can assume then that we're not going to see any pictures. Is that correct?
Actually, later this morning, and Keith Morgan, correct me if I'm wrong, there is a press conference scheduled for the time right around closest approach. That's about 7:50 Eastern or 4:50 Pacific.
Yes, there's going to be a press conference at that time, and NASA's supposed to have a live feed where they're going to it's at about that time that it's supposed to give us all the information that we're going to need at this point and whatever they've got, animations. See, and so forth.
See, what they've been doing is taking data all this time. Even while we're talking, it's taking data, recording data. It's about 100 to 1 in terms of what they record versus what they send back. Mm-hmm. The percentage that they're going to send back is about 1% in this next few hours. What they're recording is 100 times that. So then after a suitable pause, which will be this evening, they'll be sending back a few frames. Then they turn back around and take more data. And then tomorrow night, Wednesday night, is when they're going to send a big chunk of data back and do another update. And then the next chunk of data doesn't get sent back until July 20th, which just happens to be the night of the debut of my show, The Other Side of Midnight, formerly on the DMDN network.
How fortunate.
It just kind of works out. So I wanted at this point to bring in another one of our panelists. Keith, you can continue doing whatever you're doing to get ready for when we have our first guest. And you, if there's any announcements from Mission Control, I presume we're going to hear those live in the background at some point.
Yes. We'll have the live feed coming to you guys shortly. Okay.
And what we're going to do in the meantime is we're going to go to another one of our panelists. His name is Richard Grossinger. I've known Richard for, 30-some years, Richard?
Let's see. We'd have to count. I think it was 1986. So, yeah, 30.
My gosh. Richard is the publisher of Monuments of Mars, my first book on this extremely intriguing subject of what's really out there. And he is also an anthropologist. He has published several volumes. How many books have you totally published over the years, Richard?
It's an embarrassing number. I count 40.
Oh, my God. And he's got one in particular he wants me to mention because it is a very good book, and it kind of describes lyrically the backdrop to the stuff we're going to be talking about this morning. It's called The Night Sky. But the one we want to talk about this morning is the one that you called me up, I guess it was a year ago, a year plus, and you said, would you like to contribute to a book I'm doing on Pluto? And I remember I said to you, well, I'm not sure because does it fit down what Enterprise Mission has been doing over the last 10, 20 years? So I went away and I kind of looked at some things and I came back to Richard and I said, well, darn and behold, it really seems to be something we should be doing. So I agreed to do a chapter. It's now, 15-20% of the book?
Yeah, it's a good chunk of the book, and it is all the illustrations in the book.
And the book is called Pluto, Dark. Dark Mission. New Horizons for a Lost Horizon. Pluto, New Horizons for a Lost Horizon, which, of course, was the title chapter of my chapter, which Richard quietly appropriated for the entire book.
At Richard's suggestion.
So when you put this book together, Richard, what did you have in mind in terms of communicating to people that this mission, this encounter that we're covering this morning, is a lot bigger than just a spacecraft flying by a ball of ice?
There's the simple, straightforward level to that answer, and then there's the deeper level, which hopefully we'll get into. The simple, straightforward answer is that Pluto is not just an astrophysical object, it's a cultural object. It's a marker for a whole set of human symbols and meanings. And it's impossible to have a completely neutral Pluto flyby that's, of course, it's not impossible, we're doing it. But at the same time, the transfer of all this Pluto information into the culture is going to trigger all the Pluto references and reverberations that Pluto has had since its discovery, and then going back before that to the meanings that it borrowed that were embedded by the Pluto myth. And then subsequently the meanings that have been invested in it by all different people, astrologers most notably. Now, this is not something that the NASA folks will countenance or consider part of what they're doing.
Do you want to tell them,
Richard,
do you want to tell them the story about some people you invited to be part of the book who ultimately said no?
I could, if it doesn't ruin inviting them, because you're inviting those same people to be part of the show, and hopefully they will say yes, or they have said yes.
Well, the show is about telling the truth, so just proceed. Tell everybody the truth.
I contacted the people in charge of the Pluto mission, Alan Stern, initially, when I was first starting the book, I had a good contact because a college classmate of mine, a former astronaut, knew him very well. And so he was in touch with me, and he put me in touch with one of his assistants, an astronomer in Boulder. And there was a lot of enthusiasm for what they could do with us on the book. And I really wanted them to contribute material, whatever they chose. And I was very candid about the fact that the book would have literary writings, astrological writings, mythological writings, psychological writings, etc. And then on the day that I was to have the conference with them, I got a very terse email that simply said, we decline participation in your project. And that was that.
How much time elapsed between the first time you approached Stern and the time that this all happened?
Probably less than a month.
Mm.
It was like we had the initial discussion. I spoke to his assistant. She said, Dr. Stern wants you to talk to this woman in Boulder. A call was set up. I spoke to her, and then I spoke to her only to introduce myself and she herself, and then we set up another call for 3 weeks later. And on the day of that call, I got the email saying we declined participation in this project.
Hmm. And your speculations?
Speculations are free. So I can, as you know, Richard knows that better than anyone, I think, that I know in the sense of cosmically free. The simplest speculation I have is that they thought maybe it wasn't such good publicity for NASA as a whole to be associated with astrologers and psychologists and so forth in regards to Pluto. And, they worry about their funding and stuff. I mean, that's just my loose speculation. I haven't dug deeper into the paranoid realm for further.
Did you ever talk to Hoffman about what was going on behind the scenes?
He's a man of few words, so I tread kind of gently with him. I deal with him as my college classmate, and I have to laugh. Maybe 20 years ago at an Amherst College reunion, I remember the classes ahead, we were the class of 66. The classes ahead of us were very straight. The classes behind us got weirder and weirder. Mm. And I remember at a picnic, they have 5-year classes. So somebody from like the 10-year class of 76, I think, approached him with a radionic disc taken to space. And I remember that interchange as he had, just take this into space, this radionic disc. And he was very cynical about it. I can remember, I think you know this, Dick, that in the early 70s, before he was really famous, I did an interview with Carl Sagan for the journal that preceded our press, the journal Io, named after the moon of Jupiter.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a kind of, ultimately futile, but very interesting kind of contention with Carl about whether there were any meanings to planets other than those that could be discovered by spacecraft and telescopes.
Oh, that must have been a fascinating conversation.
And I argued that I reproduced that conversation in this recent edition of The Night Sky, the whole thing, because I think it's, this many years afterwards and after Carl's no longer with us, it continues to resonate for me, and I was not articulate enough to know how to deal with him at that point. I was too young and kind of eager. But over the years, I've realized how, you know, in our days now, when materialistic science like TEDx and all has drawn such a clear line about what it'll tolerate and what it won't tolerate, I now see how deeply and unconsciously political all this is, and how religious it is. And I'm not gonna take some new agey position here and suggest that I feel any differently than scientists, that you have to go and photograph these objects and in order to get certain information, and that that's really special. And if it weren't special, we wouldn't be talking here today. On the other hand, that doesn't eliminate the fact that we're working out of a cultural and psychological context, and every meaning that's coming back from Pluto, even the most scoured, pure astrophysical meanings, are coming through the filters of our own history, our own culture, our own consciousness, and they're being altered. There is no pure objective meaning coming out of space, and that out of the universe. And that, I won't get into it, but I'll just touch upon what I think the larger picture here is.
We can get into this. We have time.
Okay, well, I just think that we ourselves are embedded in a much more complex universe than conventional science has yet discovered. And I'd be, you know, a fool to say I have any idea that I could characterize that universe to you right now. But I sense that all the information that's come in from string theory and quantum mechanics and before that Einstein, all point towards our being embedded multidimensionally in a fabric of exquisite subtlety and complexity, and that the raw physical event that we see and that forms the night sky and that provides the planetary orb in orbit that's being photographed by this flyby, that's embedded in a much, how to say it, it's the way the universe inverts in. It's in string theory, there are all sorts of other dimensional factors impinging here. And so when a scientist says, no, this Pluto mission is only about the photographs and taking pictures of this object, that doesn't take into account the fact that in this larger multidimensional picture, human consciousness, the entire existence of creatures on a planet has a whole different meaning when you switch dimensional framework. So we don't actually know in the larger picture what we're doing. It's kind of up for grabs. And I'm being cautious here because I know that Richard Hoagland, with whom I'm sharing this time, has his own take and his own picture of this, and I don't want to try and push mine overly forward. His and mine match up insofar as we both agree about the overall complexity and about the fact that there are multiple factors that are not being made public, and we even share some agreement on what some of those are. But then we have different trajectories from there. And I want to leave my statement open so that there's space to include the way in which he looks at Pluto and sees ramifications in this mission far beyond what will be disclosed by NASA, or certainly that we expect.
Richard, may I break in for a moment?
Absolutely.
Are we talking about a spiritual concept here?
Well, yeah, but many people, if you use that word, many people will immediately flip into a certain meaning of that. And
yes,
what I'm talking about is a point at which the spiritual context and the kind of multidimensional quantum physical, relativistic, string theory are all the same thing, because there is only the one universe. There isn't a spiritual universe and a physical universe. There's one universe, and you can see it through a spiritual lens, and it will give it a particular coloring. But you could look at that same spiritual complexity through a purely non-spiritual lens, if you're a mathematician, if you're a topologist, or if you're a Jungian psychologist. There are all different ways to view the mystery of the universe. So for some people, what we're talking about is spiritual and metaphysical, and yet there are ways to talk about that same intricacy and that same level of profundity without invoking any of that.
Okay.
We're about to go. Go ahead, Dick.
No. I'm glad you clarified that for me, though. It seems to me what you're saying is that man, in the species sense, has really only begun to scratch the surface.
Yeah, that's certain. I think that that's true. I mean, every modernity thinks that it's the absolute acme. I mean, that's modernity. We're in modernity, but 100 years ago and 100 years from now, they'll also be in modernity. So
Dick and I are thinking in kind of 50-year chunks, Richard.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Well, in 50 years, modernity will be different, and this will look quaint.
Let us go to a break here. We'll come back in a couple, 3 minutes, and I want to pick up on the idea that you and I might have a difference in our interpretation of the importance of the Pluto flyby, because as I started delving into the book, you know, the book, Pluto, New Horizons for a Lost Horizon, repeat book title many times this morning, I realized with one of those lightning flashes of clarity that you and I have been talking about two sides of the same coin.
Well, I think that's true, yeah.
And a lot of the people you invited to contribute to this book are saying things around the edges of some of the things we've been investigating. So when we come back in a few minutes, we will pick up on that note. Well, that's a really interesting Bell promo. Is that kind of a preview of some of the things that Art's going to spring on us? I don't know. You'll have to tune in on the 20th of July, just before my show. Art's is, of course, called Midnight in the Desert, and ours is The Other Side of Midnight. So we'll get back to The Other Side of Midnight tonight. It is now about 3:34 here in the desert, in the beautiful Land of Enchantment in New Mexico. You know, Dick, one of the things that impresses me about the 50 years that's gone on since we did this the first time is how distributed we all can be in collectively doing this together tonight.
Like, well, it's amazing, yes.
I'm here in Albuquerque, just north of Albuquerque in the desert. Richard Grossinger, where are you right at the moment?
We moved from Berkeley after 38 years to Portland, Maine last year. So you're in Portland.
You're in Portland tonight, or this morning.
This morning.
And Mr. Bertel, where are you hanging out these days?
I'm in a suburb of Washington, D.C. called Gaithersburg, Maryland.
Oh, my gosh. I know it well.
Do you really?
Yeah. My parents had a bed and breakfast in a restaurant there.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, that's where the FBI raided us. Right there in Gaithersburg, down the street.
Think we can pursue that story, or is it not appropriate for this program?
Well, I think I just kind of let it hang out there for all our dear skeptic friends.
If they were able to be here, they would not recognize it today,
oh,
because it's so built up as a result of industry and medicine coming into this area, you know, Mediplex and places like that, MedImmune, which is right up the street from our house.
There's a kind of a main street that wanders through the town.
Yeah.
And there's a Roman Catholic church. I think it was St. Martin's. Yes. Yes.
Yep. Okay.
And there's a school next to it. That's the school I went to.
Oh my.
That's where I had nuns hitting me on the knuckles with rulers and things like that.
I assume this is before I met you in 1963.
Oh, yes. It was a tad before.
Okay.
And then over that bridge, there's a concrete bridge.
Yep.
As you go, I think it's west on that little street.
Yeah. And that little down, street, by the way, is a four-lane highway now. But
it's,
go
of
ahead.
Course, yeah. Well, it was just a little street, and we used to walk from home to school and back on that street. And of course, our parents were, my mother was freaked out that I was walking by. Even in those days, that was the main thoroughfare of Gaithersburg. Well, Gaithersburg, Maryland.
Yes, that's
small
exactly
planet.
Right. Yeah.
Well, let's get back to what Richard was saying, because the reason that I wanted to bring him in on this, other than the fact that he's my publisher, is because I think this little book, and it's not very thick, you can read it, you know, relatively easily, and then you're going to read it again, and then you're going to read it again, because there's all kinds of gems I found in it. But it looks at this multicultural, multi-mythical, multi-symbolic backdrop to this place, this world, this Pluto, this system that we're in, flying by this morning. But it looks at it in terms of its unphysical or unmeasurable to most people influences on the general culture. And let me give you one thing that I just was struck by a couple mornings ago. Pluto, of course, is the god of the underworld, kind of synonymous with or not synonymous with Hades. These are Greek conceptions, Roman and Greek, but primarily Greek. And lo and behold, what is happening now that is going to determine some meaningful direction for this entire planet? But the activities going on around Greece and the euro and the European common market and the banking system. In other words, in this period where we're intensely focusing on Pluto, a Greek god, suddenly Greece is in the news and is part of our consciousness in a very meaningful and underlying way. Is that some of what you're implying in this book, Richard?
Well, of course, I didn't know about Greece at the time we put the book together.
I'm talking about general concepts.
General concepts, yes. That you hate to be overly literal because it's misleading as to what we're really talking about. The literal, like a literal connection like that will cause a certain portion of the audience to say, yeah, you can make any connection you want and make it sound like something.
Yes.
But likewise, when Pluto was discovered, it was in the interbellum period when the clouds of World War II were gathering, and the notion, certainly the darkest part of the 20th century and the 21st century, you know, the Holocaust, other Holocausts that followed in the 20th century, 9/11, presently ISIL, all of these things are Plutonian in the old Greek mythological sense, in the astrological sense, and in all sorts of other subtle senses that brought the Pluto frame of reference into our culture. But it's not an underworld in some sort of nihilistic, apocalyptic sense. It's the kind of key to transformation. It's when the human penetration of the universe hits the actual density and texture of reality and flips into something else. Years ago, the poet Robert Kelly said it to me. It's when you approach the darkness that does not precede the dawn, but the birth of a radically new order of things. And I think that's the beauty of Pluto. I mean, as dark as some of these things are, and you know, the Islamic State has almost intentionally tried to impose the most Pluto-like images on the planetary consciousness, that they are still operating within the bounds of them. They cannot escape the meaning system, the unconscious meaning system of the whole planet and of the species and of all the other intelligences that intersect here at this plane. And that's kind of what I think we're both referring to in one way or another. And, you know, little literal connections like Greece, the Greek myth and Pluto, or Hitler and Pluto back at the beginning, those can bubble up to the surface and you can, you know, they're cute. You can take them or leave them. I don't think ultimately either Richard or I are referring just to that. I think we're referring to the cauldron, the sort of underlying cauldron through which these things bubble up, and a kind of deep intuition that you feel. I mean, it's some of the excitement you feel about the flyby and the images, that these are resonating with destiny. They're not just flat pictures of rocky landscapes formed out of algorithmic molecular activity over millions and even billions of years. They are also evoking something in the greater the intelligence of the universe that goes beyond what we have defined as the human sphere.
Well, you know, in terms of our own work, and for Dick Bertel, who is not, I think, Dick, you're not totally up on what I've been doing over the last 50 years. So it's fair to say that a little recap for you would also maybe help the audience. When we got into this research, you know, looking at the possibility of ET artifacts in the solar system, looking at the prospect that there's NASA data that has not been freely shared that we could find on NASA websites and in hard copy. As we got into this and we discovered at Cydonia, which is the region on Mars which has the face in the pyramids, that there appeared to be some kind of a mathematical message laid out in the placement of those objects, those structures, it became apparent eventually that this was some kind of communication a la what the great 19th century astronomers had envisioned for their first contact with possible Martians, a la, you know, H.G. Wells and War of the Worlds, where there were famous astronomers, well-known international astronomers, who recommended creating geometric symbols in deserts or in pine forests, like in the steppes of Siberia, that would communicate to any Martians looking at the Earth with telescopes that, in fact, there was somebody here that was alive and conscious and knew mathematics and had a grasp of the physical sciences, et cetera, et cetera. Well, if you turn that concept around, one of the really astonishing things of our early work was the discovery of that kind of a geometric message laid out in these ancient Martian ruins that could then be decoded. And the decoding led to the idea, a prospect, of a whole underlying physics in parallel to the physics that is part of the mainstream, using electromagnetic radiation like light and radio waves and things like that. And then I found out many decades later that there was a whole group of Russian physicists who'd been studying this alternative sphere of physical influence. They called it the torsion field because the motion of energy information through this field is in a rotary torsion fashion, like vortices. So I have been using the term the torsion field to describe this meta-reality. And what I figured out from my own work over the last 30 years is that this field can be modulated by consciousness, and in turn, consciousness can be modulated by changes in this field. And there is a wonderful book by a guy named Dewey, Edward Dewey, called the Study of Cycles, who was called in by Herbert Hoover, Dick, if you don't remember this part of history.
Well, I do, as a matter of fact, but go ahead.
well, this was the Great Depression, and Hoover is pulling out his hair. You know, what the heck is going on? Why is the greatest country on the planet going to hell in a handbasket? So he turns to this mathematician named Dewey, and he basically said, figure out what the hell is going on. And Dewey goes away, and he comes back, and he says, Mr. President, I think we have a bigger problem than just the economy. Because what Dewey found is that there were a whole bunch of cycles in nature, from the migrations of certain animals to the stock market fluctuations to the sunspot cycle. Oh, someone's not muting their mic. To the rotations of the planets around our star, mm-hmm. that all appeared to be in sync. And he produced a set of graphs showing that there was some, almost you could call it a master timekeeper, which somehow behind the scenes was ordering these various independent cycles of various activities and life forms on the planet into a series of very synchronized parallel cycles. And when you look at the graphs that he published ultimately in his papers and in his books and through the foundation he created called the Foundation for the Study of Cycles, you find that all kinds of things that should not be physically connected by our, you know, 21st century mainstream scientific approach, we think, are somehow, in fact, being impelled by some unseen driver to be in synchronization. And it's that unseen driver that we call, and the Russians call, the torsion field, which others have called the ether. But in fact, it's a matrix in which our reality is emerging from. And if it's amenable to consciousness influencing it, and if consciousness is amenable to changes from physics of that medium, then you've got the setup where all of the symbolic and mythological and archetypal representations of this Pluto icon can come filtering through reality, as well as a whole bunch of other symbols and icons. And that, of course, leads us to our discovery several years ago that NASA, for some reason, is planning these missions to correspond to the maximum effectual nodal points where what they're doing, in fact, can influence consciousness and thereby history.
So they seem to be aware of this concept as well.
At a very deep level. And Richard, yeah. Is that the reason?
It could be unconscious. It almost doesn't matter if it's conscious or unconscious.
But you see, this is the argument that Mike Barra, who's my co-author on Dark Mission, and I have had for years. What part of it can we identify to a conscious arranging of the pieces on the chessboard to have the maximum effect by means of this unseen torsion background medium? And how much of it is the medium and the resonances in the medium simply impelling human behavior? In other words, do we live in an ultimately deterministic universe and basically we're just living out a script?
No, I don't think it's deterministic.
And Bertel is laughing his head off.
Well, every moment is every moment in this universe and in our existence is in some sense has already happened, and in another sense continually has yet to happen and has infinite possibility in it. And that paradox and contradiction points towards the actual complexity of the system, which is beyond our conception. And at that level, it doesn't really matter whether NASA is conscious or not of its manipulation, but it certainly isn't pre-programmed.
Yeah, but wait. I can prove to you.
That's too linear.
Well, by your anthropological perspective, let me bring to you a physics. If in fact we're talking ultimately about waves in a medium, exchanging information and energy in a seamless recurring form, and it's being modulated by the motions of various celestial objects, you know, rotations, revolutions, precessions. Then there's got to be this interplay between the consciousness of humans and the physics of the universe. And part of it has to be those folks who are determined to organize their events, their pattern, their activities in a way that maximizes their influence on this unseen medium and thereby history. And I can prove to you that NASA specifically chose tonight, this morning, for this second flyby, Dick, from the one we covered 50 years ago to the night.
I was amazed to learn that, yeah.
Because one of the key numbers in our hyperdimensional torsion field physics model turns out to be the number 19.5, or any iterations of 19.5, like 195 or 195,000 to infinity. In other words, it's the 195 part, which is a resonance indicator that something of a hyperdimensional or torsion field nature is in fact occurring. And when we do the measurements, we find that some of these ancient structures that Robin and I have run around the world looking at with the our measuring technology, the so-called Accutron measuring technology, which basically demonstrates that the field can change the vibrational frequency of a mechanical resonator, in this case a tuning fork, in the Accutron watch, by the way, that came out, Dick, in 1965, the same year that Mariner 4 flew by Mars.
Yes.
I didn't realize that until relatively recently, that I've been now working with a technology the last several years that was invented and put on the market by Bulova the same year that Mariner went to Mars.
That's amazing.
I see all of this as synchronistic.
Well, hang on. Hang on.
Let me
get to the punchline. Okay. Because as putting together this show, actually putting together the chapter for New Horizons for a Lost Horizon, I realized suddenly that NASA had gone out of its way to put the Mariner 4 encounter date 50 years ago, Dick, on the 195th day. July 14th is the 195th day of the Gregorian calendar.
So that occurred in 65, and it's occurring
and
again.
And then 50 years ago, NASA arranges for this encounter to occur on the 195th day.
Yes.
Because 195 or 19.5 is a symbolic indicator of the physics. And Richard, I will argue very, very strenuously that this is not a cosmic coincidence, because the odds of this happening 50 years apart on the same night is 0.0000001. Or something like that.
Those numbers don't mean anything in synchronicity. Synchronicity,
but they do in physics.
Beats all the odds.
But they do in because
that's why we're two faces of the same coin.
Well, then you're telling me that the effort to track down which is planned ritual and which is just synchronicity, a la Jung, is not easily determined, kind of like Heisenberg, that there's a fuzzy boundary where at some point we can't determine which is the chicken and which is the egg.
Well, yeah, but I think I'm a great believer that you're running on your track, and that it's completely authentic, and that you're running on it because you're getting at some deeper truth. So when I see what you're doing, I may not agree that all this stuff is actually intentional and planned by NASA, but I do see the very fine intelligence by which you're tracking this, and I think it's totally interesting. But no, I don't think that NASA pays any attention to it. And the launch of New Horizons, as I'm sure you know, was delayed by winds.
By decades.
At the time.
But you're referring to the specific launch, Richard. Yes,
the specific launch of this, grand piano was I think supposed to be a day or two earlier, and there were high winds at Cape Canaveral.
Hang on. That doesn't matter. You can make that up in the rocket. In other words, a few days plus or minus doesn't determine when you arrive. You just make it up in the burn times or the mid-course corrections or whatever. I'm saying that NASA specifically planned the Mariner 4 flyby on the night of the 195th day, which I did not know then. It took me 50 years to look back and say, oh my God, that's what they were doing. And then 50 years later, to the exact night, they've done it again with the last flyby of the last classical planet discovered by Tombaugh in 1930. To close the loop, to put the other
right.
book
well,
in.
Well, this sort of has NASA as a kind of Rosicrucian organization, which is hard for me to believe.
No, NASA's filled with Masons. If you go to the – he's laughing. if you go...
Well, I'm not laughing cynically. I'm just laughing because I've known you a long time.
and we know that the Masonic tradition, I mean, James Webb, which Kennedy handpicked as his administrator of NASA, was a 33rd degree Mason. If you go into what Masons believe, you know, not all the weird, stupid stuff, but the actual stuff, Masons are into enlightenment, into education, into greater social morality, into building intelligence, building civilization. Again, if you're part of an agency which thinks you can push the river by doing these things at certain times in the time matrix to reinforce the resonance, then this is exactly what you would see.
Well, who is doing this at NASA? Who has this this capability, this knowledge?
Well, that's a very good question, isn't it? We know there are certain people who are part of this, shall we say, ancient religious perspective, because Masonic traditions can trace their origins back to Egypt. I know there are a lot of naysayers who think that, you know, the Freemasons only came out of, you know, 16th century or 17th century Europe. No, in fact, it's much, much, much older. And there are many authors over the last several decades who have written really exquisite volumes like Knight and Lomas, where they trace the origins of the Freemasonic tradition, in fact, back to Egypt. So there's a lot of Egyptian mythology and symbolism around these various NASA missions, which, again, Barra and I detailed at great length in Dark Mission, so I'm not going to bore everybody this morning, but I just found it so stunningly resonant that they picked this day, the 195th day, to open the exploration of intelligent life possibly in the solar system with Mars 50 years ago, and now they're closing that era, the end of the exploration of the classic solar system with little Pluto and Charon on exactly the same day, the 195th day of the year.
Well, and there it will rest, I think, because we're not going to solve this one.
Unless I provide further evidence to the court.
No,
right?
No.
Well, let me give you one more example. When Pluto was downgraded as a planet, which is a bizarre circumstance that I wanted to have someone else join us this morning and converse.
And let me break in here with a question. That occurred, it was downgraded while this spacecraft was already on its journey. Am I right?
Exactly. After New Horizons had been scraped together, they basically somehow bamboozled the Congress into funding it. They built the spacecraft. They launched this sucker on January 19, 2006. A few months later, when the IAU convened in the fall of 2006, a couple of people, Mike Brown and Neil deGrasse Tyson, who was my heir apparent at the Hayden Planetarium in New York, he is doing what I used to do there many, many years ago, they got together and they got a political head of steam and they convinced 4% of the International Astronomical Union, 4% of 100%. Of the scientists who were part of the international astronomical profession to vote against Pluto as a planet. So suddenly Pluto is politically downgraded unceremoniously, and Ceres, which is the largest asteroid in the asteroid belt, right. It's a little body about 600 miles across, we now know, because there's a NASA spacecraft right now as we're talking orbiting the Ceres asteroid called Dawn, right after the Pluto demotion, the IAU also elevated Ceres to a dwarf planet status, equivalent now to Pluto's new dwarf planet status. When we look at the Dawn images, this is where things get really interesting. Richard, when we look at the Dawn images, we've been focusing now for weeks and weeks and weeks on a strange collection of lights, geometric lights.
That's correct.
Which appear in the northern hemisphere on a grid, because Ceres is spherical, so you can put a grid around it like you can the Earth with latitude and longitude. And lo and behold, the Ceres lights in that 55-mile-wide crater are exactly at 19.5 degrees. Now, NASA obviously didn't put those lights there. Somebody else in the model that they're artificial did, but they're at the right latitude implying that the ancient civilization that left them there for us to find is operating on the same physics that we've been decoding, and a key significator of that physics is 19.5, and so it's expressed not only in what NASA's finding in the solar system, but it's also expressed ritually in when they carry out their missions, and this is the 195th day of the year that we are flying by Pluto, not, I believe, by accident.
Okay. Well,
end of rant.
I don't think it's by accident, because I don't think anything is by accident. And I think it's totally compelling. And I'm glad you said all that about the lights, about where the, where they appear, et cetera, et cetera. I also could play devil's advocate and say, and I know the rebuttal to this, but I could say there was good reason to demote Pluto from planetary status, good astronomical reason. It's much smaller than any of the other planets, and there are a dozen or more Plutos out there beyond that form a whole separate branch of the solar system, you know, in the Kuiper Belt. There are planetary objects bigger than Pluto, out among all these, you know, things. I tend to forget their names, but Eris and Sedna and Maki and so forth.
Yep.
And some of them are even, I think a couple of them are also in Pluto's orbit. They share the same rough orbit with Pluto. I think Ixion is one of those. I think Eris may share Pluto's orbit.
Well, when we come back, we can argue some details, because I think Alan Stern, who was the PI on the New Horizons mission, would have a bit of a different opinion, and I have been reading some of his work. So since he's not here at the moment, I will paraphrase and I will give to you why he has insisted all along that the IAU went nuts and that Pluto is still a planet. So
right,
when we come back, devil's
advocate here.
When we come back, we will get into. We will also jump back in time, because we're going to go back and we're going to listen to a part of the Mariner 4 broadcast that Dick and I did 50 years ago. Oh, that number again. And you will hear us when we come back from the opposite side of the break. So take it away, Keith.